please. May your name be blessed and exalted, our King, for continually, forever and ever. Then this Aspired has, so Aspired and Aspired Him have a slightly different version of this this line. But the basic thing is that this is actually, people, at least me, I used to tend to regard this as like being separate from Modin because of the Alanisim which comes in the middle. But in fact, this is the punchline of Modin. So as we say in the first part of Modin, we talk about God making miracles and wonders and how He's very, very good. And therefore, we say to Hashem, you know what? Your name should be blessed and your name should be uplifted. Now clearly, as we mentioned yesterday, it is very, very haughty of us to come and give God a bracha. But that's what we do. We do it all over the place. We say, always say, Baruch Atah Hashem, right? But God should be blessed. And that's the basic problem which all the, but many thinkers, Jewish thinkers deal with that. How can we possibly bless Hashem? If anything, we should ask Hashem to bless us. So how we always say, every bracha yet says, blessed are you, God. God, you know, God's response, I know I'm blessed. I don't need your blessing, right? So the question is, what exactly we're saying by Baruch HaTzor Hashem. So there, the Nefesh HaChaim explains, although it's a little bit difficult to, in the words, but there seems to be no other explanation, that Baruch HaTzor Hashem is an indication, when we say, blessed are you, God, we're not blessing Him. What we're doing is we are recognizing Him as the source of blessing. In other words, everything comes from Hashem. And since everything comes from Hashem, He is the one who is, for example, Borei Min HaMezonos, the one who creates all sorts of nutrition, or Shakol Yedivaro, or everything came into existence because through His Word. So we're not saying that you should be blessed, but rather we're saying you are the source of blessing. Is that clear? So that's why it says, wherever it says Baruch Atah Hashem, it's not expressing our desire that God should be blessed, because who's going to bless God if not God Himself? But rather, we're saying you are the source of all blessing. Can we all agree about that? Anybody ever thought about that when you made a blessing?
Yeah.
Right? So what did you think when you made a blessing?
I didn't know what to think, but I knew that we could have blessed Hashem.
What? So why don't you ask?
I have many questions.
You should ask all of them.
Yeah, well,
ask them when
it's appropriate.
Okay. So this is a very basic question of what exactly a bracha does. But, that may be, that over there, when we say bracha to Hashem, it means you're a source of blessing. But that's not what it means here. Here it says, Yizbarak, meaning your name should be blessed. There I say quite explicitly, God's name should be blessed. Not that He is the source of blessing, but I want to bless God's name. Very strange thing. Again, how can I bless Hashem? What am I saying? I'm saying that God should find favor in His own eyes and bless Himself. Right, we get back to the multiple personality disorder God, right? So it's a very difficult concept. So clearly there must be something deeper going on here. It goes back to what we said yesterday, which is that the name of God depicts the relationship of God into this world, right? And therefore, the name of God, as we said yesterday, is not complete in this world. It's only the Yud and the Hey, like the Pasuk says at the end, the verse says at the end of Parshas B'Shach, the Vav and the Hey are not complete. We only have Yisum L'chol Shamayim, the heavens are happy, but not the Sogei La'aretz, not that the land rejoices. So therefore, God's name is incomplete, and the name must be blessed. What does it mean the name must be blessed? The name is missing something. It's got to expand into that missing area. By the way, the word Baruch, important note, the word Baruch is related to the word Brecha, which means a pool, and Berech, which means a knee. This is spelled Barech. It's spelled Berech. How is it related to that? So a pool means something which is a reservoir, right? A reservoir which can be added to, subtracted from. So therefore, we say that Hashem is, so to speak, the reservoir of all blessings. And when we say that we want the reservoir or pool to be enhanced, that says, say to God, we want to give you a bracha. Or if I say to you, I want to give you a bracha. Let's say I came to you and I said, listen, Yaakov, I'm going to give you now a bracha, right? Whatever I'm going to say. So that I'm trying to say that you have a pool. Your pool is right now 3 feet deep. May your pool increase to become 6 feet deep. I don't mean a little swimming pool, obviously. But you get the idea that whatever you have should expand and you should have more of the same.
How does knee fit in?
Oh, so knee is more obscure, but it also works out with knee, because the knee is something where you bend and extends out from the body, right? So something which extends out...
So you can do that.
What?
You can do that. Your arms extend.
True. That's true. But then when you do it with the knee, so then it actually comes back down to the ground. In other words, you go like this.
Especially with movement.
Associated with movement, right? So that's why when you have, let's say, in halacha, you have a tree. It's a tree. And you can take a branch off the tree and you put it down into the ground. Right? And you grow here, it goes underground, and here grows another tree from the same branch. Anyway, in English it's called literally...
There's trees in Florida like that. The branches grow and then they just go down and they sprout and become the whole new trunk and they keep growing down.
There's some word in English.
Grafting?
No, not grafting. Grafting is when you put on the same tree another tree. It's called layering.
Mm-hmm.
Layering is called. I will not know that except that I did work on that. Some work I did for Arts for Mishnayot that came up. So.
It's not mine.
No, Rabbi.
Again?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't see the word.
Working in the coal mine.
So, where's it coming from? Anyway, thank you. So this thing over here is called a beret. Because it's a knee, right? You make a twist, the branch makes it becomes a knee and goes back down into the ground. So it's something which is an extension of the tree and then comes back and goes down and creates something new.
So we're saying
a bracha similar.
Is it an extension?
What?
We're saying it's an extension?
Yes. And a bracha is similar. A bracha is like, if you think of it more in terms of this knee over here than the human knee, it works out a little bit better. So it's the same idea, really. You take something and you put it down to the ground and it grows again. That's the best called a berech or a brecha, right? And in English, a layer. And so through the bracha, it's sort of speaking an extension of something towards something else. And then, ideally speaking, also, it should be something which then grows something else in a new location. So that's how these words are related. And there's another point to be made, which is the letters Beis, Resh, and Chaf are all the letters which have to do with twos in the alphabet, right? This is 220, right? So why are they twos? Because a bracha means an extension from the one, either that thing extends outwards, or that extends towards another and imparts a blessing to somebody else. In other words, that one thing which you had before is no longer one. It's expanded either in creating something new or at least an expansion of self. So therefore, that is why you have all those letters which have to do with two in this word. Another word which is similar, of course, is Bechor. Bechor is the firstborn. The order is different, right? But the same idea. A person's firstborn is an extension of himself. That's why it has the same thing, Beis, Chof, Resh, describing this extension of this individual, right? Oh, a whole bunch of words like that, right? We've been playing this word game all morning. Rachav. What does Rachav mean? To ride. Because you have a horse and a rider. When you have a rider, it defines, by definition, it means that something is riding on something else. In modern Hebrew, an automobile is sometimes called a rechav. I don't know if it's proper Hebrew or not, but in any event, the idea is, again, you have somebody riding in something else, that's called a rechav. Right? So that you have duality. So this word always seems to have denote something which has duality to it or two-ness to it. The only other word I can think of offhand, which comes from this, is it's kvar, which means something which already was. I'm not sure how exactly that relates, but I imagine...
Can you bless something that already exists?
What?
Because you already blessed something.
Well, it means, no, Kvar means something which already happened, not necessarily something which is blessed.
Yeah,
well, sure, that would be the potentiality that's there, right? That was already created, so it's just to actualize that potentiality, maybe, right?
It could be. Well, it's
it could be a stretch, but...
Yeah, but it could be something. In other words, it implies that there's not just the present, but also the past. So it could be
right.
Along those lines. In any event, so bracha means all these things are all connected. So the we're talking about here the shame of Hashem being this barech, it has to mean we want it to expand, to fill up, to complete. By the way, you know, in the way that Arizal describes Kabbalistically, the metaphor of the creation of the universe, the Arizal says that the first thing God created was what?
Matter.
Flower.
Emptiness. Oh, right. Vacant space. Right? So the vacant space has the God forbid the vacant space. All the Kabbalists say you have to be careful when you depict this because people don't realize it's a metaphor and they take it literally, but you guys are very bright, right? So you're not gonna take this literally.
So here's the point of darkness.
There is no spoon?
There is.
There's no spoon?
That's the darkness, right? Imagine the muscle is that initially there was all white light, which is all the presence of God. And then there had to be a vacant space for everything else to exist. So God vacated this space. It's not completely vacant. There's still like a residual godliness there, but it's very, very slight and very, very difficult to perceive. And then after God vacated the space, then he made a, what's called a kaf, a line.
Kaf?
Kaf. A line. And in this line, there's a little bit of illumination which comes into the vacated space. There was this limited illumination, for example, what we have, Torah, you know, Tanakh, Shas, that's a little bit of illumination, or whatever, even nature, if you take it as being representative of God's creation and a sign of God's presence in, or God's creation of the world. So that all is part of that little point of light which enters into the vacant space. And man finds himself over here at the middle of the vacant space, and he's supposed to now try and extend that light which came down to him out and illuminate the vacant space as much as possible. That's our job.
Why?
What? What do you mean, why?
God said so.
Why was man created to do that, or why is man's mission to do that?
We've
explained that why man was created to do that is because God wanted to have an entity which was physical to which he could impart good things, or separate from himself to which he could impart good. We went through that last week, didn't we?
I guess, but I still don't know.
You still don't like it.
Why would he need that?
He doesn't need it.
Just because he's full of chesed, right?
That's he doesn't need it. It's not a question of need. It's a question of want.
It's about tone, right?
Yes, it's about tone. Exactly. Right, it's important to know, we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Ratzon is language of rat, going out, which is the antithesis of something which you need. When you need something, it means I have a cavity,
a
rack within me, right, which must be filled. Whereas the Ratzon, ideally speaking, should not come from an emptiness, but on the contrary, from a fullness. When something is full, the cup runneth over. It shouldn't just run over and spill, but rather it should be directed at something, right? So therefore, that Ratzon, which Hashem has, Ratzon Hashem, is something which doesn't denote a lack, but rather a drive to have something take place. Okay? It's the same thing with human beings, right? Some people are very needy, and that's why they get married or have kids. Other people have usually it's an accident, but theoretically, people are just get married, have kids because they're very needy. Other people get married, have kids because they have a drive to give and to create and all that kind of good stuff. Usually it's a mixture, either it's an accident or a mixture of both. It's never perfectly one or the other. But ideally speaking, you know, if we just think of it very simplistically, there are those two approaches. One is because to fulfill a need and the other to be able to give. Yeah.
Everything
that Ratzon is, or what's said, is not what we thought it meant,
which is I need something.
Right.
What would be the word for needing?
Usually the word for needing is chafetz.
Oh,
chafetz. Right. Chafetz, chafetz chaim, right, exactly. I didn't tell the school about my first grade Hebrew teacher. No? When I was in first grade, we had a teacher, Hebrew teacher, Mora Geyer. And Mora Geyer taught us, I don't remember very much from Mora Geyer's first grade class in Hebrew Academy of Napa County, but I do remember that she taught us, when she taught us that when we have to go to the back room, we're supposed to raise our hands and say, Ani chafetz lotzeis, which means, I want to go out. And it was kind of like archaic Hebrew, because in modern Hebrew, you almost never use the word chafetz. You use the word rotzeh, right? We almost never use chafetz. Okay, so she was from the old school. Already back then, she assumed that she was 9 years old. She probably wasn't that old, but in any event, it could be that that's why she thought of us that way. But, in fact, technically speaking, she was correct. That chafetz is different than rotzeh. This I learned only a couple of years ago. That ratzon has to do with something you will. And you just do something spiritual. Right? And the person doesn't will to go to the bathroom. Doesn't work that way, right? Right. It's something which a person needs, as I'm saying. A person has to attend to his needs. So therefore, when it's something which a person needs in a material sense, that's called a chafetz, or the verb for that is chafetz. So therefore, there's a difference between rotzeh, which is something where I will to do something spiritual, or chafetz, where I need to have some material need addressed. So therefore, we have a difference between... Who asked this question just now? You asked, right? There's a difference between chafetz and rotzeh. And like you said, niya isha chafetz chaim, right? That clearly means somebody who wants life, right? He wants physical life. And that's something which obviously is a very strong chafetz, which everybody has.
I think that someone, going back to what you said about getting married, just because I'm getting married, somebody wants to get married, someone wants to get married just for the sheer fact that they need to, not to take, but that they need, what was it we said, that they need to...
create.
No, not those two. You said one is to create and one is to, because they're needy.
Yeah.
Right? It's very unhealthy, I think. I think it should be a balance of both, right? Because, I mean, we never really lose... Without getting really deep psychologically here, I think as humans, we never really lose that drive as people who need, right? I mean, we always need to some degree. Like, we came into this world needing from our mother and from our parents, and like, we never just completely separated ourselves from that. We would be isolated up on a mountaintop, right? We need to be with other people and receive from them. I mean, that's how the whole give and take relationship, right? It's just about finding a healthy balance and not just making it all take or
a harmony, yes. But I know that's, I'm not so sure that that's the right analogy, because chesed work could both be giving, not necessarily taking. But you're right, in a certain extent, one could understand it that way, because this is masculine and feminine's propensities to harmony between the two. It could be, it's interesting, parallel. I wanted to say something about the word chafetz, once we got on the topic. Chafetz, you said, means a material desire or material want. I don't know exactly how to translate the word chafetz. I really don't know. But this much I can tell you, that it is related to something which is lacking. How so? Because it's related to the word chafar and chafan. Chafar, anybody know what chafar means? Chafar means to dig a hole. A chafira is a hole in the ground. Okay? And chafan means, I don't know if you say this in English, when the Kohen Gadol used to go take the Kedoshah on Yom Kippur, he would take him a little chafna, his palms full, and they go like this. This is one chofen, and this is chafnayim. So this is called a chofen. So actually when you do this, you're creating a receptacle with your own hands, right? You're creating like a dugout.
A divot.
What is this?
A divot.
Divot?
You know when a golfer strikes and hits the ground? No, really, it did it. And they hit the ground, and like they tear up that patch of grass and leave a little indentation, like a small piece of ground.
It's called a divot?
It's called a
divot.
D-I-D-E-D? Yeah, I have to look in the dictionary, but yeah, it's called a divot.
Okay.
So it's kind of like...
It's the thing. Okay, that's a
good word. That's very important. It's a SAT word.
So if you have this divot, so that's considered to be a hole, right? It's just like a chafira as a hole. So the idea of chafetz, I assume, is linked somehow. I don't know why the tachon is a tzadik. So each one, each Hebrew verb has two letters, which are the under, assuming that they all have three letter shrush and three letter root. So two letters are basic, and the third one is a tacon to distinguish it from other similar ones. It's not a random tacon, there's a reason for it, but here the parallel is because these are chet pei verbs, right? And you also should be able to figure out, if you're good at it, why chet pei means something which is a lack or a hole, and different types of lacks or holes are then defined by a tadin or a resh or a nun, and so on and so forth as you went down the list.
So, well, I'm sure you can try two methods. One is to, there's a book that discusses each letter of the Hebrew alphabet and its significance.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is, I don't know, I haven't looked at other letters, but it knows to it's clear that there are holes, like in the chet and the pit.
What's that?
It's an enclosure.
Mm-hmm. That's an idea. It should also be, there was a fellow who, he didn't finish well writing his family office, lived before the war in Poland, the Krakow. His name was Aaron Marcus, and he wrote about this theory, and he wrote about how the letters sound. In other words, you have to look not just at the letters as they denote all sorts of, you know, mystical or intellectual concepts as they're written, but rather the sound. Sound specifically together would indicate something lacking as opposed to any other sound, which is much tougher to do.
So we could even say, I mean, this is maybe a stretch, but we can say that the path to the tzaddik, to the righteous, is through a digging, if you will, an excavation of self, right? A mining of the self, right, can lead to the tzaddik.
Yeah, sure.
Righteousness.
It's not bad.
Well, what's the negative space and what's the positive space? So like you have a block and you either make a hole in it and you pour a mold into that shape, and then you removing that, you have the shape, or you remove the thing itself, the substance itself, and carve out the self, or you can even with the self build the self up.
Right.
Yeah, but those would be two different things. You'd have a clone.
A clone of an aspect of Hashem.
Wait, that's another leap. The thing would be as it is of itself, and then when you have a mold of that, that is a copy of that. But that
tells you not visualizing your language. I want to understand what you're saying, but I'm just not visualizing.
So if you're making a form of something,
right? I got that, a mold.
You can remove. Well, that would be different. That would be a mold. That's one way of making it.
Okay.
Because it's also taking a block itself and reducing every space around it, looking into a block of wood and seeing your bust and making a bust of you.
Right.
Okay. There's making a mold of it,
and there's making
a mold of that, and then you're making copies of that. That would
so
be
what about the stone? The analogy of a stone,
or building something up. You have wood bits, and you take this block and you cut it into bits, and you build the Yosef bust out of it.
Or you excavate all your negative Yetzirah and turn that into something in the service of Shem. We say that somewhere in Davening also, right? Say that may my evil inclination be subservient to you, right? So maybe that excavation is digging out that evil inclination and making that matter subservient to Hashem. Could be, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's the concept of the rock we read in Moses, you know? It's like we talked about hewing this rock from the quarry, and, you know, I mean, I don't know. Could tell you that.
It's a good line of thought. I want to point out two other things. I'm not going to have offhand, you know, a good interpretation of it, but a few other things I want to point out about this. I want to work on this for homework.
Okay.
First of all, the other words which have to do with chet pei are chafa, or to hay, which actually means the opposite, means to cover.
Uh-huh.
And then you have also the word chafas. Chafas is, I think it means to hover.
Hover?
The hover. You like a hover
above?
Hover above.
What,
Gracie? Yeah, Gracie.
Rubrika
King?
So, two letter root.
What?
It's a two letter
root. No, it's a
three letter
word.
But it's two letter root.
It's two letter root, right.
Are there many two letter roots?
No. The assumption is, the hypothesis is that all three letter roots has two letters which are additionally the core of that root, plus the tack-on letters that distinguish the similar ones, or related ones.
There are a lot of different metaphors.
Who's third is that?
Using what? Material that
Dr. Aaron Marcus.
Then
I thought he was the one who said the stuff about the sound.
Appears by the bracha to Binyamin, to Benjamin, in Parashas of the bracha. A Benjamin, Moshe said, may Hashem's beloved dwell securely by him. He hovers over him all day long and rests between his shoulders.
Does he use that word when it says Hashem hovers over the face of the waters of Bereshis?
No.
It doesn't use that? Then maybe it doesn't mean that. This is Merachet. Maybe it means something else.
No, maybe you're right.
Yeah, it's the same
letter.
It's just rearranged. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's
arranged
afterward.
I'll buy that.
Okay.
Okay.
This also means to hover
Mirachet. Although I think that there is different. I think that that's a kapala word, although I don't know what the difference is between the two. That rachat is the root of that. So it's rachat is similar to chafaf. I don't know what the difference between the two of them is. They're both ches peis, right?
Uh-huh.
But one of them is, this is a ches peis, that's a peis ofis, it's a point of peis.
Right.
Ches peis, and this is also ches peis, ches peis. So in any event, there must be this relation between the two. I just don't know exactly what each one means.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have chipeis, which is very good. Chipeis means, what does chipeis mean?
The search
or the seek. And of course there's the word same or spelled the same way, chopesh, which means what? Freedom. Right? Yeah. That says I have it in Hebrew, Chavshi is Shalchenu. So Evachan, so freedom.
But what is distort? What is distorting?
I don't know modern Hebrew. Modern Hebrew is for my yang. Hmm? Modern Hebrew is for my yang. In ancient Hebrew, it would either be Lissader, the range, or it would be Broar, to left. I don't know another word for sorting in the classic Hebrew. In any event, all these, if you really want to go through it, for example, you have to go and find how ches pei relates to all these words, right? I would also assume that the gematria of ches pei, which is 88, they're both 8, right? You see that? Ches is 8, and pei is 80.
And what is 8? It's transcending the natural order, right?
8 is something, right. 8 is something which is 7 is natural, 8 is supernatural. Right. So there must be something which has to do with that also. Yeah?
Do you have a book recommend on the origins of ancient Hebrew? I just don't quite understand, you know, how these words got created.
I don't know if this book is translated into English, this book which Dr. Marcus wrote. So the best one I know of offhand, which is not great, is the Art Flow book.
The long, the mythical.
Yeah.
I don't know, but the author's name is Monk.
Michael Monk.
Okay. There's the Barlon rabbi, author, writer, and Talmudic, who wrote a book called, I think it's Histories of the Hebrew Alphabet, and he has a lot of religious presuppositions in writing the book about the rise of the alphabet and this sort of thing. I think it's the Histories of the Hebrew. He wrote two popular literature books on Gemara. I think what's called the Burned Book. The Burned Book. About Talmud being censored and destroyed over time. I think it's called Mysteries of the Hebrew Alphabet. Oachnin is his name, but I don't know.
The problem is, these books is that you have to find somebody who takes all three aspects into account. Three aspects means the mystical connotations of the letter, the way the letter is written, that was its shape. So the shape also is significant. And the way the letter sounds. Because the kind of sound it makes is also significant. So, and it's very hard to find somebody who's going to deal with all three.
Alright, because that one I just have a certain group. animals, but I haven't heard about the non-Hebrew, but I've never heard about how all these ones.
You'll find it's a matter of dispute. Like all the things in Judaism. Where the letters we use today, the class, was the Siddur letters handed out in Mount Sinai, and the Torah was given those letters, or they were letters which developed organically, and in fact didn't develop in the land of Israel, but developed in the land of Ashur, which is why they're called Ashurian letters. Right, much later in Jewish history. So it's a big issue of contention between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. The Bavli Old Torah was given and always brings in the block letters we have, which is called the Assyrian writing, just because it became popularized when it came back from the Assyrian diaspora, the Assyrian exile, whereas the Yerushalmi holds the Torah was given in ancient Hebrew, which is the way the Samaritans write their sacred Torah to this very day, which to us would be illegible. And it's only at the time of Ezra that it actually changed over what we have now, the Hebrew block letters.
I'm sorry, are they Paleo Hebrew or ancient Hebrew?
What?
But the pictographic Paleo Hebrew is ancient Hebrew.
I don't know which one. I can't tell you offhand.
Not just the letters, the words as well. The words themselves
evolve. The words can exist without an alphabet.
Oh, yeah.
Words are not necessarily an alphabet. They're two separate things. I mean, there are tribes, which are illiterate, but have, languages.
So we ascribe all the wisdom of the language to just the organic wisdom of the tribes?
No. We assume that the language itself has its own sanctity. Right? And then the question is there a specific alphabet which conveys that sanctity over any other alphabet? You see what I'm trying to say? That's why it's important to know, not just the way the letters are shaped, and where the origin of the letters came from in terms of shape, which is a relatively mundane issue, but rather why different sounds have different connotations, and why also the mystical associations with each letter. As an abstract concept, in other words, you can have the letter Ches and not have any way to spell it yet. It still connotes eight, because that's its order in the alphabet, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So then it has a specific, set of values which it's trying to represent as a result. Then there's how it's written, which is a separate issue. Though how it's written reflects the deeper meaning of the letter as well.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds that has some sort of original sanctity. But then who decides how to put those sounds together to create words?
Well, either God, which we assume is the case by Hebrew, the world is created in Hebrew.
For the Torah.
Or it's by human convention, perhaps the languages later on. Mm-hmm. But you assume...
So not all these words are in the Torah.
What?
Not all these words are in the Torah, but most
of these words are in Tanakh. Not necessarily the Torah itself, but in Tanakh. Yes, the modern Hebrew words which are made up, most of these words are in Tanakh already. Dr. Marcus in his book, who's called by Zilai, I don't remember why he gave that funny name, but in his book by Zilai, he goes to one verb, what was the root of one verb, the Ches Resh root. And he says Ches Resh is at the root of many destructive words. Why? Because Ches and Resh, he says, are destructive sounds. Actually not a rotary. So those are both destructive sounds, and since they're both destructive sounds, so therefore, words like cheret, which means sword or destroyed, chalav, which means anger, chalav, which means to tremble, all these things have to do with the chet resh or the resh chet sound. What? Well, chet is with the test.
It means the combination of the two.
Ruach is very destructive force. The Torah and the Torah, although they're not together. But not totally the same thing. But in any event, so as I say, it's hard to find, I've never seen a book that deals with all these aspects.
Is there some sort of midrash on the giving over of all these words?
On the words themselves?
On the words themselves, yeah.
Maybe we should write one. Okay.
Now,
seems like an interesting
20-year research
project.
Interesting
design story to tell about how all these words
were created. Yeah, it was. We have it, but they're in Tanakh, and we don't know exactly where words originated, except that we assume that most of the Hebrew words came from Hashem, as the first language which was spoken, one through which God made man, and which man first conversed in when he rose up, was Hebrew.
Okay.
So some parts were instilled in. and a letter Ches is pronounced this way and so on and so forth, there must be some connotation which it has. Is it found explicitly in the Gemara? Not usually. But there are hints to it in the fact that, say, the Tzira takes the letter seriously, so seriously and so on and so forth. Okay? So, all this we've gotten on the topic because it's gotten on the topic of bracha, right? So we say that Hashem's name should be blessed.
It's my
fault. So when you say Hashem's name should be blessed, that means that we want His name to expand. It should fill up the world.
And it just is.
Yeah. Yisborach, and then we say Yisromam. Now it's interesting because Yisborach and Yisromam are really two contradictory things. How so? Because something which is raw, what does raw mean? High. Something that's high, by definition, it's separate. Right? So therefore, if you want Hashem's name to be blessed, what you mean is you want it to fill places. Expand. So how can you then say, Yisborach Yisromam, it's a contradiction. Isn't it? On the one hand, you want it to be expand, and on the other hand, you want it to be very high. How do you reconcile the two of them? So, there are two ways of understanding that. One way of understanding that is that, well, it's true, the Empire State Building is very high, but it does touch the ground. So, we're saying that it should be very high. People should recognize how high, so to speak, Hashem's name is, but that doesn't mean it doesn't reach all the way down to the ground as well. It's both high and low. But I think there's a better way to understand it, which is somewhat more profound, which is, if you take a look in the Siddur, most of us don't say this, but if you take a look in the Siddur on page... on page 606. Some people say this after Shabbos, every Shabbos. They say a bunch of passages, and the passage we're looking at here is the last passage from 606, 607, which is from taken from the Talmud. As you see, it says, Rabbi Yochanan said, wherever you find the greatness of the Holy One, blessed is He, there you find His humility. That's the way of understanding that. Right? You find His humility, they're two separate things. His greatness and His humility, which is a paradox. But nevertheless, then you don't find both. But the deeper shot is, what's God's godliness? What's His greatness? His greatness is His humility. In other words, God would not be so great if He was just a king who remained in his palace and had nothing to do with the masses. That's not a big deal. That's not great. That's isolated, right? That's haughty. That's not greatness.
The philosophers.
What?
The God of the philosophers.
Right. But then there's a... I really should close on you right now, but I'm not going to. The, what?
Why?
What's the topic?
But the greatness is that somebody, that the king should be accessible and be in constant touch with his subject and listening to them and dealing with them. That's true greatness. That's what we're saying. The greatness of God is the fact that He can is manifest everywhere. It's, again, the greatness is not in His being separate and high, but rather His highness is demonstrated in the fact that He is with everybody in every situation. Okay? So that's to say, Yisborach and Yisromam are not contradictions to each other. So we say, of course, that Hashem's name should be blessed forever, right? So it means constantly, and lola means eternally. They're two different things. Constantly means not always, within eternity. Eternity is the length of time for which it should exist. So we want Hashem's name to be constantly and eternally blessed. It hasn't happened yet, right? But the idea is that this is something which we're dominating for. And really, the Kabbalists say the whole of one's prayer should be directed. I don't know how you do this. You know, I'm not a Kabbalist, right? Even though I'm over 40. But I'm not a Kabbalist. But the Kabbalists say... What?
Kabbalists.
So not much of that either. But the Kabbalists say that one's entire prayer should be directed at trying to extricate the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, from its goals. From its exile. With the Divine Presence in exile, meaning Hashem cannot manifest His presence in this world. So what we're saying here to Hashem, why? It's our fault, because we're thinkers, obviously. That's kind of the implication. So therefore, what we're saying here is we're davening. We're saying, you know, we really want to have your presence, meaning your name, manifest in this world. We're yearning for the time where that will occur. Problem is, when we say Shema Nesra, we usually are not particularly attuned to what we're saying. So therefore, we really don't yearn, even though the words express that idea. We don't express it with our heart. And moreover, even if we express it during davening, we don't necessarily express it by our actions. And actions speak louder than words. But, ideally speaking, a person is supposed to take this idea with him from Shema Nesra, so on the last Shema Nesra, that everywhere I go, I want to make a Kiddush Hashem. What's a Kiddush Hashem? What's a Kiddush Hashem?
Sanctify the name.
Sanctify the name, right? It's a strange thing. Why don't we say, what is in Kiddush Hashem? So you could say Kiddush Hashem means, well, we really want to say Kiddush Adonai, but we don't say it because we don't use God's name in vain. But that's not the truth. Kiddush Hashem is Kiddush Hashem. What it means is, you're supposed to go wherever you go and whatever you do and expand God's name. How to expand God's name? By doing the right thing where you're supposed to do and exemplifying the right thing where you go. What's the opposite of Kiddush Hashem? Chil Hashem, right?
It's decreasing.
No, it's not decreasing.
Yeah.
No.
First call is decreasing.
No.
It's always decreasing.
It's
always nullified. You know what this vacant space is called here?
Chol.
Chol. A vacant space is called Chol Chol.
I have it in my notes. No, not this class. From another class. Chol Lamed.
Chol Lamed.
Means to degree.
No, Kodesh Lechol, that's what you mean?
No. There was a rabbi who went through this.
Right.
This rabbi was wrong.
He said that the combination of Chasek and Lamed.
What?
He said that if we can find in any word where we see Chasek and Lamed together,
Chasek
and Lamed, it means decreasing something.
Okay,
that I remember. That was...
Don't tell me it was.
No, I'm trying to remember the it was... We were learning it in the in a parsha. It was in a parsha that we were looking at. Because he said, "Why is there a chesed lamed here?"
Right.
Okay, but what I can tell you is a chalo. It means an empty space. That's what it means. So maybe they're related.
Decreasing a full.
But but the point is, chil Hashem means a place in which God's name is not present. Right. In other words, we puncture, so to speak, or we make a place void of God's presence. That's the idea. A Kiddush Hashem expands God's name into this area. A Chil Hashem vacates this area of God, and that's why we need to have Yisborach Yisroel Am Shimcha, meaning to expand God's name into these areas where it doesn't yet appear. Yes.
Good. I'm trying to put this together. Because Hashem's name is not present, because the Shekhinah is not present in the Beis Hamikdash, because we don't have it, is that the reason why we're no longer allowed to pronounce Yod-Kei Lesvav-Kei?
Right.
That's the reason?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they pronounce it up until the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and then we stopped pronouncing it.
Mm-hmm.
I
only in the Beis HaMikdash.
Okay.
So, isn't, going back to what you said about the Shekhinah, can you go back a few pages? What did you say exactly? There's no place for it to manifest Hashem's name? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Without the marital relations between husband and wife?
That's a Gemara, right? That's what it says.
Okay, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, so take what the Gemara says. The word Ish has the Yud, and the word Isha has the Hey, right? So if you have the Yud Hey, which is the Shekhinah, then, everything works out fine. If you don't have that Shekhinah because your house is dysfunctional for whatever reason, then it's Ash and Ash, right? Fire and fire. And that's the end of that. But the fact that Yud, the Shekhinah Shriya Beinenim, the Yud and the Hey, it doesn't mean that the Shekhinah is manifest in the same way as manifest in the Beis HaMikdash. If you need proof of that, it's only the Yud and the Hey, where's the Vav and the other Vav and the other Hey. So there's a sense of affinity and connection with the divine. But it's not the same thing as the real Shekhinah, which we're looking for, which is a much more manifest and explicit thing. The Chazal also say, Lo Lam Lo Zav Zav Shekhinah Min HaKlesh Samar Ravi. I mean, mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, that the Shekhinah never moves from the Western Wall. Which is why if somebody goes to the Western Wall in our day and age, you should feel there's a divine presence there. But not divine presence which exists in Beis HaMikdash. It means there's something left, a vestige of divine presence. Because Shekhinah is not a specific size or shape. It can be, you know, expanded, right. Contracted. So therefore there is a vestige of Shekhinah there. There's a piece of Shekhinah, so to speak. That's not the word I was looking for. But a piece of Shekhinah here as well. But the totality of revelation, which is possible to accomplish in the creation with the Beit HaMikdash, with prophecy and all that stuff, that's what's said about the Shekhinah and Golos now, what we want to see redeemed.
Oh. I don't know, it seems like also that point of insemination, of conception, would also be a point of view, right? Seems like it could be.
And therefore what?
I don't know, I'm just thinking like, therefore, the connection to the Shekhinah, like that's what the I don't know.
It could be, but that's also only a very small...
You say it's just fragmented?
How
can we fragment the Shekhinah at all? Is that possible? Fragment the Shekhinah? That sparks of Kedusha, that's what we're referring to, the sparks, the Shekhinah divided...
No, the sparks of Kedusha is something else. Sparks of Kedusha, not Shekhinah. By elevating sparks of Kedusha, that's part of Arizal's Kabbalistic doctrine, which is that by elevating, by gathering the sparks of Shekhinah, we give more capacity for the Shekhinah to be revealed, but not that the sparks of Kedusha themselves are Shekhinah. But if I use this table to Lashem Shemayim, all the paper which is used to make the Siddur, we elevated all the sparks of Kedusha which were in this paper, right? But it's not that the Siddur is the Shekhinah, right? The Siddur, by using the Siddur, we, so to speak, are able to bring more Shekhinah down into the world. Of course, at the same time, there are many other things going on. One of the other pieces of paper which are printed as part and parcel of magazines and other stuff, where they're making the Shekhinah go further away from the world. So it's not necessarily a net gain, it may be a net loss. But everything we do has capacity of either bringing the Shekhinah closer or the Shekhinah further away.
I thought also like it had something to do with, I was reading something about the fifth commandment about honoring the parents. Says, why is that on with the first Lukos? Because all that.
But that's like God. They're like God. Not that they're Shekhinah, they're like God.
Right.
There's an emulation of
man's parents. Relationship with his creator, like, and the parents are put on the side of the creator, so the man's relationship with his fellow man.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so like in that case, the word like God, I mean, it's, I don't know. It seems
that doesn't mean that the Shekhinah, your parents, father and mother, is walking around with the divine presence attached to them.
No, I just mean
that. But it means
that
you treat them with that. No. It means you treat them with the respect that you would treat God.
Right, but I'm just saying.
Regardless of where
that moment of creation, like where they're coming together to create.